Okay, I'm going to get started. Thank you everybody for coming to what I think is something like the 28th LTC Policy Forum seminar. And just before I get on to introducing our speaker, just a very quick look from a project that I'm involved in called the Propensity for Cycle Tool. We've just got some new briefings on cycling potential across England out, so if anybody wants one, just give a shout afterwards and I can give you a copy to have a look at. But we're very excited to welcome this evening Professor Ralph Buhler from Virginia Tech, who I'm sure many of you know Ralph's work, for instance, the very well-cited paper, Making Cycling Irresistible. And Ralph is going to talk this evening for about 50 minutes or so, following which there'll be plenty of time for questions and answers. And Ralph's topic is Reducing Car Dependence, Lessons from Europe and the USA. So I'll hand over to Ralph.
Okay. Thank you for the introduction. Thank you for coming. I'm excited to be here. The presentation tonight will focus on five large cities that have reduced car dependence. We look at Zurich, Switzerland, Vienna, Austria, and then Berlin, Hamburg, and Munich in Germany. First, I'll present trends in reducing car share of trips, and then focus the main part of the presentation on policies implemented to make driving less attractive and other modes more attractive. I'll conclude with a little case study of the political process of implementing these changes in Vienna, Austria. And Vienna, Austria is also what you see on the slide here. You already get a sense of the city as being fairly high density, but also having a lot of green space. Before I start, I want to acknowledge the co-author of this presentation, John Fuker. Some of you know him. He sends his greetings to those who he knows and those who he doesn't know, so feel greeted. Most of this information comes from two papers that were recently published that you can see down here, also together with Alan Altschuler and Regine Gericke and Thomas Götzschi. Background. Why is it relevant to look at reducing car dependence? We've seen worldwide increases in car ownership and use for many decades, but more recently we have seen in high-income countries stagnation or even decline in car ownership and use in some countries and in many major cities in Europe and North America. In some ways, Germany, Switzerland, Austria have been at the vanguard of promoting walking, cycling, and public transport while discouraging the use of the automobile. So we focus on these five cities, the largest cities in these countries today. We first look at daily travel trends since 1990 and what happened in mode choice, and then look at the package of fully integrated policies that address all modes and make walking, cycling, and public transport more attractive. The goal is to identify successful policies to reduce car use and to examine the political process using the case study of Vienna, how to implement these policies. This slide shows you the increasing trend in motorization measured as cars and light trucks per 1,000 population between 1970 and 2012 in various high-income countries. You also notice in the little boxes down here that the growth rate per decade has been declining, but the trend is upward. It's led by the U.S. on top, and then you have various European countries. Then here, the dark colors, that's Austria, Germany, and Switzerland, that are sort of together, at least, in 2012 in their motorization rates. Also increasing has been the share of trips made by automobile in the countries that have seen increasing motorization. It varies quite a lot. You see all the way to your left, the United States, with 86% of trips by car, going all the way down to the Netherlands, and then Switzerland with less than 50% of trips. You also see quite some variability in the share of trip for bicycle, for example, with the Netherlands, the large green part, they are 29%, and Denmark, also larger and green, with 16%. Public transport also higher in Switzerland, Sweden, Germany, and Austria. There are some differences here in these data in exact trip purposes and methods used, but it gives you a sense of the levels of car use in those countries. While the car offers many benefits, it also creates problems, and car dependence creates problems such as CO2 emissions and climate change, environmental pollution on the global and the local level, roadway congestion, fatalities and injuries from traffic,
suburban sprawl, unequal accessibility, especially for low-income individuals who may not be able to afford to own and operate a car, or those who want to be without a car. And related to that, things like lack of physical activity by adding yet another sedentary activity, driving, to daily life. The next two slides show you two correlations. This is a correlation between the percentage of trips on foot, bike, and public transport on the horizontal axis and transportation CO2 emissions per capita. That's ground passenger transportation CO2 emissions. You see the U.S. on top there, and you see the downward slope of the curve in Germany and Austria there. We see a similar relationship looking again at the walk, bike, public transport share on the horizontal axis and the vertical axis, traffic fatalities per 100,000 population. Again, the U.S. is sort of the outlier, but then you even see the relationship there between the other countries. In our case study, cities are not alone in having reduced the car share of trips among European cities. This shows you Stockholm, Hamburg, London, Munich, Berlin, Vienna, Copenhagen, Zurich, Amsterdam, and Paris. And all of them have reduced the bar shown in black, that's the percentage of trips, daily trips, made by automobile between about the early 1990s to 2010, 2015, and have increased the share of trips for other modes. Our case study cities are here. Vienna stands out with the largest decrease, a 13 percentage point decrease in the car share of trips. If you look more closely at Vienna, that's here in the center, you see that most of it has been picked up by public transport, a little bit by cycling. If you look at other cities like Munich, for example, you see that the cycling share is picking up more of the mode share from the car. Again, there are differences between surveys and cities and geographic definitions, but it gives you a sense of the reduction in car mode share. We also see that in North America, this is New York, D.C., Boston, San Francisco, Chicago, Portland, Minneapolis, Atlanta, L.A., and Houston, but not all of them have reduced the car share of trips, and this is the commute share by main mode of transport to work. Here we have Portland, again here, Oregon in the middle, leading by minus 8 percentage points, but also District of Columbia minus 7 and New York City minus 6, but this is not a trend that happens everywhere. Some cities that don't get a circle here have not reduced the car share of trips, and others like Atlanta plus 8, Houston plus 3 have even increased the share of car commutes during that time. A quick comparison of our case study cities. They're all large cities, with the exception probably of Zurich, still the largest city in Switzerland, a smaller country. Berlin is the largest with 3.4 million inhabitants, and they're all the center of even larger regions. If we look at population density, we see that that Vienna and Zurich are denser than the German cities. In terms of wealth, Berlin is the poorest city in terms of gross domestic product per capita adjusted for purchasing power parity. Zurich is the wealthiest city. If you wouldn't adjust for purchasing power parity, Zurich would stand out even more. This shows you the trend in cars and light trucks per 1,000 population in these cities from 1970 to 2010. And you notice increases in motorization up to 1990, in some cities up to 2000, and then stagnation or much slower growth in motorization rates. Berlin has the lowest motorization rate, and then Munich, the home of BMW, has the highest motorization rate here. But in all countries, you see sort of a similar trend, especially Berlin, Zurich, Vienna, and Hamburg, of this stagnating or even declining trend in car ownership. One note of caution, we are talking in this presentation about the cities themselves and not about the suburbs. And the trends in suburbs are quite different. This graphic shows you for each city, the bar to your left is the city center, the second bar is outside of the city center, but still in the city, and the bar to the right is the suburban areas. And what you see is the share of trips by car is much greater as you go to the from the city center to the suburban areas. The share of trips on foot is falling. The share on trips for public transport is falling. The bike varies somewhat and still has quite a healthy mode share. That's the green bars here, even out in the suburbs. But the rest of this presentation focuses on the cities themselves. The motivation for implementing policies to reduce car dependence came in all of these cities out of rapid increases in car use and motorization up to the 1970s that started causing problems within the city, such as congestion, air pollution, noise, parking overflow, traffic injuries, and fatalities. Adding to that, energy crisis and increasing environmental awareness generated some public support to start retooling or changing the transport system. In the following, I will now go through four sets of policies, starting with walking, moving to cycling, public transport, and then the automobile, and look at policies that were implemented in these cities, and with a lot of photos and graphics. The photos were mainly taken by me. John took some of them. Some of the photos you'll see are not from the case study cities, but we're using them to make a point. I'm not a good photographer, so we just didn't have nice photos to show. Here are the policies that are implemented across the four cities to promote walking. These are car-free pedestrian zones, traffic calming, home zones with even more traffic calmed, shared streets, better sidewalks, crosswalks, intersection, education, enforcement, and improved signage. So all cities, the slight exception of Berlin, have car-free pedestrian zones in their downtown areas, often starting as early as the 1970s. They have been expanding those areas. It's not just in the city center, but they have also spread into neighborhood areas. For example, Munich has 22 car-free zones. Zurich has 11 kilometers. In Vienna, the area used for pedestrian and car-free zones has tripled since 1990. So you have the city center, but then you have also these smaller traffic, smaller pedestrian car-free areas in neighborhoods. And you see the two pictures in Vienna there, and then one from Freiburg in Germany where there's a little fountain where the kids can play in. So Munich has 22, Hamburg has 20, and Berlin has 16 of those. We've also seen in all of the cities a trend towards mixing of modes of transport, so allowing delivery trucks into the pedestrian zone, allowing taxis into the pedestrian zone, or mixing pedestrians with trams. Or the photos on the bottom in Zurich is lowering the curb and sort of encouraging pedestrian trams, bikes to use that space at different times. So there's a trend towards mixing of modes. I've brought two videos, and I hope they work, and I have to turn off the sound because it's not a good sound. This one is from Freiburg, Germany, where you see how public transport and pedestrians are mixed. In the summer, I take students from Virginia Tech to Freiburg typically, and one of the assignments is they are sitting in this car-free pedestrian zone and they see how the trolleys and the pedestrians interact. So this shows you the mixing, and this is just an everyday occurrence that the light rail at very low speed is mixed with the pedestrians. Initially, when they proposed this, they had trouble getting federal funding for it because federal funding required to have separation of the right-of-way. And if you have ever been to Freiburg, you will notice they have little rivers going through the city, and they argued that these rivers are the delineation of the right-of-way that allowed them to get the funding. So that's just to give you an impression how this works. The next little video, the last for the night, is from Vienna, Austria, and that's a more organized shared space. This was implemented as a shared street. It required a referendum. It's on a street that's in the middle of two city districts, and residents of both together agreed to put in this shared street. It's a former, well, still a major shopping street, but cars were dominating that space, and now it's a space that is used for. It's a shared space where pedestrians, cyclists, and cars and scooters share the space. And again, a short 1 minute video of how this space works. And Maria Hilfer Straße is the name. And cars are allowed in at a very slow speed. You see here on the right hand side, they have drop-off areas where cars can park to load and unload. They cannot park permanently, but they can get in there and have their space. And you see how the pedestrians, the cars, and the bikes are mixing, and these two cars are now, they are stuck behind the person with the little suitcase, and they go at quite a slow speed. And you will not cut through that street if you have to go somewhere quickly, so you only go there if you have to drive through that street. but has been politically quite difficult to implement this and talk about this a little bit later. But again, this trend towards sharing. Zurich now has 17 kilometers of these shared streets. Vienna has 3 kilometers. Berlin has pilot projects, and Hamburg has planned shared spaces for 7 city districts. More common in the city is traffic calming. These are mainly neighborhood streets where speeds are reduced to 30 kilometers per hour or less, with 85% of streets in Munich, 78% in Berlin, 75% in Vienna, but half, 50% in Hamburg and Zurich. The ones I've chosen here, and you have them in London here as well, are always traffic calming measures where cars turn into neighborhood streets, and what's happening is that cars are mounting onto the pedestrian level before they get into the neighborhood streets. So it's not the pedestrian going down into the car space, but the car getting into a space that is pedestrian, considered a pedestrian space. Again, traffic calming measure, this time not speed, but volume, a dead end. The volume will be zero because cars can't get through, but allowing cut-throughs for bicycles and pedestrians to get through these spaces, and cars cannot go through. Home zones are super traffic calming, so the traffic speed is between 7 and 10 kilometers per hour. Officially, I think it's 7 kilometers in Germany, but the police say they cannot enforce lower than 10, so if you drive 10, you're still okay. The length of these, the number of these streets in Vienna has tripled from 11 to 32, and you see what they changed the pavement. The speed is low. The lower right-hand corner is, again, is from Freiburg. That's a whole neighborhood that's designed as a home zone where cars are also not allowed to park permanently. But all cities have many of these super traffic-calmed home zones. This is a map of Vienna, and all the colors you see in pink, in green, and in blue are traffic calmed to 30 kilometers per hour or less, and that's the dark green. The light green are park areas, and so what's left, what's not traffic calmed, are the yellowish areas. And they increased the traffic calmed areas from 30% of the road network in 1990 to 75% in 2015. We have those as well in North America, not as extensive, mainly limited to certain roadways in Charlottesville, Virginia, even Santa Monica, California. The other one is in Quebec, Quebec City. There are about 60 such small pedestrian malls. The number 60 also includes malls where buses are allowed in, like in Denver or in Denver, Colorado, or Madison, Wisconsin. The most popular example is probably the transformation of part of Times Square and Broadway in New York City. These are pictures taken in the trial period where they just put out sort of cheap-looking furniture and allowed people to use the space. And then after the trial period, it was made permanent. And essentially they changed the pavement color there, and they put in pedestrian seating and amenities. New York City also has put in the High Line, which is a former elevated freight rail, that is now a pedestrian walkway, almost too popular on nice days because too many people want to walk there. We have pedestrian areas on college campuses, also mainly on the West Coast. Cycling can be very high on college campuses, which brings us to the second group of policies, looking at policies that promote bicycling. And the backbone of this seems to be extensive networks of connected off-road bike paths, on-road bike lanes, bike priority streets, shared streets, and traffic calm streets, so that it can cycle from one part of the city to the other without cycling in the road with fast-moving traffic or high levels of motorized traffic. And of course, you have other measures like bike sharing, promotional events, etc. In this area, Munich did most of our case study cities. The bike share of trips in Munich by the latest travel survey is 17% now. But it also doubled in Berlin, Hamburg, and Vienna at a smaller level over that time period. The bike paths and lanes can look different on the upper, not sure what it is for you, left-hand side here, we see Munich, where you have the bike facility right next to the pedestrians on the curb. This one is in Vienna, again, traffic separated. with the green area in between. Again, Munich on-road cycling, quite wide bike lanes there. This is a special cut through in Berlin, where there's even a sort of a separate tunnel that is used by bikes and pedestrians. Munich has increased the bike routes from 750 to 1,400 kilometers over the time period we looked at. In general, the German cities have more bikeways per capita than Zurich and Vienna. In on roadways that don't have a lot of traffic and car traffic and a lot of fast-moving car traffic, cyclists can share with drivers. These are pictures from Munich, Zurich, and Vienna, where bikes share the roadway with slower-moving car traffic. This is a traffic-calmed area in Vienna. What you notice here is the one-way for cars. Bikes can go both ways, and you see the traffic-calming measures of the bulb outs forcing a more 90-degree angle turn for the cars, slowing them down. Of course, you have to watch out when you cycle with trolleys. You have to know how to cross those tracks. Intersection treatments are important, especially if bikeways are on the curb and drivers may not expect cyclists to get to the intersection. This is a treatment that we have from Münster, Germany, where it's quite common to sort of have a colored bike lane carried through the intersection, alerting the driver that cyclists are there. We have the bike boxes. I've seen also quite a few bike boxes here. Some of them, I'm wondering how the cyclists get to the bike boxes because they're not connected to a bike lane, but we can discuss that later. But so ideally, they're connected to a bike lane that leads into the bike box, allowing cyclists to stop in front of cars, increasing visibility, ideally also giving them a head start, also not waiting with the tailpipe emissions. Putting it all together, this is a map of Berlin. And what you see here is the road network, but only indirectly. It's the bike paths and bike lanes in yellow, red, and green, the off-road bike facilities. And then what you don't see are the traffic-calmed roadways. So they're only providing these special facilities on higher traffic volume roads. And they've increased their bike share to 13% of trips. Again, they use a variety of these measures we already talked about. They still have these old home zone signs, sort of going back to the time when there was no standardized sign in Germany and the cities were sort of experimenting with it. I quite like this. It tells you that it's walking speed, but it's not an official federally sanctioned sign. Bike parking is important. Here we have bike parking at a rail station, just not sheltered bike parking elsewhere. Hamburg has something innovative. When I showed this to John, he said, why are you showing a pissoir? It is not a pissoir. It is a bike parking shed that the city provides at apartment buildings, because often there's no space in apartment buildings to take the bike in and out. And so they have 340 of these bike sheds that hold 12 bikes each. And they have different colors. This happens to be a green one, but you can find them throughout Hamburg. Bike parking statistics are not that easily available, but what we found is Munich has 83,000 bike parking spots, 26,000 counted in Berlin, also 26 at rail stations in Hamburg, but they're not necessarily comparable, those statistics. Bike sharing, all cities have bike sharing systems, as London has as well. Vienna had the oldest of this generation. They started in 2003 already with a third generation bike sharing system. The Munich has 1,300, Berlin and Hamburg about 1,700 bikes in bike sharing. Zurich only has 300 bikes, and I understand they are looking to transform their system, but their system consists of these kiosks still, where they employ unemployed individuals, and you can check out bikes, and you get the benefit there is you get a variety of bikes. You do not just get one type of bike. You can have a cargo bike and other bikes you can get from these. But they are not the third generation bike share systems as we also have in Minneapolis, Minnesota, or Washington, D.C. down here. Munich's system is free-floating, so they don't have the docking stations where you dock in the bikes. As I said before, sometimes data for cycling can be difficult, so data collection and communication is important. This is in Vienna. They have a bike counter, which many cities have. These days, when bikes go by, they get counted, provides visibility for the cyclists and to everybody else, but also provides data for politicians and for researchers, either to promote cycling or to analyze cycling, and of course also Here they are handing out flyers and other things for cyclists. Events, for example, in Berlin, they have an annual event called the Sternfahrt, where they sort of go to the center of the city with about 200,000 cyclists. Hamburg has 20,000 cyclists in that. Training of cyclists is important. In Germany, school children between third and fourth grade get bike training in schools. If you live in a large city, they may even have what they have here in Berlin, a bike parkour with little traffic signs and little roads, and the kids learn to cycle around there. And then if you live in a municipality that has enough money, they would even have police to take you out to cycle on real-world facilities. Washington, D.C. is the first U.S., the first U.S. state that has adopted this now, starting this last May. Second graders, I think, in D.C. get bike training. Safety enforcement. The cyclists here, stop the booing, probably. But enforcing the rights of cyclists towards motorists, but also enforcing the proper behavior of cyclists. And also, this is for school children, where their bike gets checked, and if the bike doesn't have working brakes or whatever, they have to report back to the police 2 weeks later and show the bike is in proper working condition. Training motorists, that's the other side. Teaching motorists what to do around cyclists, looking over your right-hand shoulder when turning to the right, knowing when bikes or pedestrians have the right of way, knowing to anticipate that children may not necessarily look out while you drive, so you get ready to brake. I got my first driver's license in Germany, and so I learned about these things. I got my second driver's license in New Jersey. There was no mention of pedestrians or cyclists in New Jersey, so things can improve. All of our case study cities, and it's related to safety and safety training, have sharply reduced traffic fatalities per 100,000. This shows you early 1990s, we used two-year averages for those, and then 2012, 2013, and reductions from around 5 to 6 per 100,000 down to about 1 to 1.5. So huge reductions in overall traffic fatalities. Many U.S. cities have also made progress on promoting cycling, and Canadian cities. This is in Vancouver on Hornby Street, a before and after. This is in Portland, Oregon, which is sort of the bicycling capital of the U.S. There's a bridge across the Willamette River where you have the brightly colored bike facility here, pedestrian facilities over here, a trolley and car lanes. So it's sort of a complete street for everyone, but also including these cycling facilities. This is New York City, which has built 138 kilometers of cycle tracks over the last decade. They're physically separated from motor vehicle traffic. Here you see they have their own lane and their own signals. Cars have a red signal for the left turn, and this is in Manhattan. But also they have done it more and more throughout the city. But the core is in Manhattan and Brooklyn. Bike boxes exist as well. You can have a dropped stop line for cars, and bikes can jump the queue or get ahead of cars, again increasing visibility. One problem for cyclists in neighborhoods in North America is that typically you have four-way stops at intersections. So that means that every intersection you're supposed to dismount and look, and then you go again. So it's not very comfortable. So they, mainly on the West Coast, they've implemented bike boulevards. These are roadways along which they have eliminated the stop signs if you cycle on the bike boulevards. The cross streets still have the stop signs. And then they have put in traffic calming because it would make it very attractive for cars as well to use those roads and go through the neighborhoods. Often they use turned one-ways, so one block will be one way for cars this direction, the next block will be the other direction, and bikes can go either way. In some cities, they have now started calling them neighborhood greenways, so not just focusing on bikes, but also focusing on improvements for pedestrians and the entire neighborhood. But it's mainly on the West Coast. Conversion of car parking to bike parking. These are pictures from Portland, Oregon, and from San Francisco, where car parking spaces are taken out to be turned into bike parking. Especially in a city like Portland that has a high bike mode share, they get requests from businesses to have bike parking in front of it. It's, of course, more difficult in areas where there's a lower share of bike riders. bike events, summer streets, where certain streets are closed in New York City, attracted 300,000 participants. These are pedestrians, rollerbladers, and cyclists, but in August 2016. The next set of policies looks at public transport, and here Vienna and Zurich have done more than the three German cities. But all cities have expanded service supply, they've improved the quality of public transport, and all of them have introduced deeply discounted monthly and annual tickets. This shows you the trend in public transport passengers per capita per year. So how many public transport trips the average resident of the region makes. All of them show increases, the highest levels, more than one public transport trip in the region per year for Zurich and for Vienna. All have increased the supply. This shows you place kilometers of public transport service. It's a measure of the seats available and the standing space available on buses and other public transport vehicles. All but Berlin have increased the public transport supply per capita quite considerably. A key backbone to make public transport more attractive are these Verkehrsverbünde, which are regional public transport associations that now, and it's a map of Germany, serve about 85% of Germany's population. All the little boxes you see here, or sometimes large around Berlin here, indicate a Verkehrsverbund where all services, fare structures, and ticketing are integrated to create a seamless transfer across operators and public transport modes for the user. And the motto is one network, one timetable, one fare. It all started in the mid-late 1960s in the Hamburg region and has since then spread all over Germany. More and more German states are now offering statewide transit tickets, but only after the main peak time in the morning. Austria mandates statewide Verkehrsverbünde, so there's a federal law since the early 2000s requiring it. This is the Vienna Verbund plus the two states surrounding Vienna, and now they serve 100% of Austrian population. Switzerland, only Zurich is the real Verkehrsverbund. Other associations exist where you have one fare or timetables are integrated, but they don't do all the things that Verkehrsverbund does. Deeply discounted monthly and annual tickets. This compares the cost of single tickets to the cost of various other tickets. And what we did is we looked at two public transport trips at a single price for every workday of the year. So taking out vacation and taking out holidays. And then you get a relative discount if you bought this other ticket. You see the monthly ticket here. If you buy an annual ticket, the discount, this is in Vienna, goes down to almost 70% for seniors. The tickets are even more discounted. University students, almost 90% discount in Vienna. And then high school students, even more discounts on these. Vienna stands out here already with the blue. And you may have heard of it, but Vienna has this, it's a political price, this ticket that costs only 365 euros for all public transport in Vienna a year. And it's a political price because it's 1 euro per day. I'm not sure how they will get away from it later when they have to increase the fare, but it's 1 euro per day. They reduced it after the Green Party joined the Social Democrats in the city government in 2012 from 449. It's among the cheapest annual tickets in Europe, Western Europe, I'm almost certain. It doubled annual ticket sale between 2011 and 2014. Senior tickets are also very cheap. High school student tickets, as I said before. Overall, public transport trips have increased. The verdict on financial efficiency on this is out. On the one hand, the revenue from tickets has not declined because the volume of annual tickets has increased so much. But at the same time, they had to put out more service, which then also increases the cost. And so depending on who you talk to, they are emphasizing different aspects of this. But the cost recovery ratio, fare box recovery ratio, has declined slightly since this ticket was introduced. What was also interesting doing interviews in Vienna was quite a few people told me that they do not really care about the cost recovery ratio, so how much of the operating cost is covered by fares, because they say somebody has to pay for public transport, And it doesn't have to be the user. It can also be the public in general, because there are so many external benefits to public transport. Something I never hear in the U.S. from anyone, but I heard it from quite a few people during interviews in Vienna. Vienna was late in getting a subway system. They started building it in 1969. They had plans already before the First World War, and things always got delayed. They then tried to make their trolley system better, but finally in 1969 they started building a new subway, and it's the first phase of expansion till 1982. Then they decided on a second phase till 2000, and then a third phase taking them to 2010, and now a fourth phase from 2010 to 2023. One interview partner described building subway systems in Vienna as a tank that was hard to get moving, and now they may have trouble stopping it because they have local benefits to that for labor unions, but also for companies that are building the tunnels, for companies that are building the cars. So they have sort of an alliance around this expansion of the metro system. Also, later we'll look at a settlement they are building out here. Just that you see where it is located. It's called Seestadt. Between 1990, that's the period we're looking at here, and 2015, the length of the network, of the subway network in Vienna has doubled. All cities have also improved their vehicles, low-floor boarding, making it more accessible for everyone, if in a wheelchair or with a stroller, but also making alighting and boarding times faster, newer upgraded vehicles, real-time information on vehicles, etc. Also real-time information outside at light rail or at bus stops. This shot at the bottom is from Freiburg, showing you spatial integration, because all above ground you can see it, but they have the local buses arriving here, and right on the same track you have intercity and regional rail, and above here you have the light rail to carry people then to the city centers. It's not just the fare integration and the timetable integration, but also the physical integration of getting to these different modes. Coordinating public transport with cycling to be able to cycle to the public transport stop. This is one of the bike parking garages in Zurich. They have one south and one north of the main train station. Also, sometimes you're allowed to take bikes on board of vehicles, but that always can clash with the capacity need for people to be on vehicles. This is in Münster, Germany, where we have about 3,000 bikes parked at the station. We also have those in North America. The cheaper version in Boston, on the upper left-hand side, the fancy version in Washington, D.C., right outside of Union Station, very, very pretty, but very expensive. It was about $5 million to build it. Somebody told me that it's bomb-proof because they were afraid somebody would put something there and blow up the station. I'm not sure if that is true, but it was expensive, that I know. Also, improved public transport, real-time information, new light rail systems, also low-floor boarding. Even cities like Phoenix that don't have a public transport history at all have built a light rail system. This one is in Houston up here. Seattle has built a downtown tunnel for their buses and added a light rail. In total, passenger miles for light rail more than quadrupled from 1990 to 2015, and now there are 43 cities with light rail systems. And some of them are even made in the USA, so that may be good for the new president, who has a nationalist economic strategy. So this is made in the USA. This up here is in Minneapolis. Bus rapid transit also exists. If you're from South America, you may disagree with this, because their definition is more strict than the North American definition of what bus rapid transit is. But the bus rapid transit-like systems exist here in Eugene or in Cleveland, going from 1 to 25 in the U.S. and 1 to 15 in Canada. The next block of policies are policies that restrict car use and make it more costly, like taxes on car ownership and use, driver's licensing, and then here what you notice, the car-free zones and the traffic calming that make walking and cycling more attractive, they also make driving less attractive. First is increasing cost and high cost of gasoline. per liter in Austria, Germany, and Switzerland. Germany is leading here with Austria following Switzerland because we adjusted for purchasing power parity, comes out lower, and then the U.S. At the bottom. The main source of the difference is taxation, and you must know about it because the U.K. is down here in this list. The orange is the share of taxes, and the red is the price of petrol. And the United States is up here, and our case study countries are here in between. All cities have implemented some form of parking management. In Vienna, it started in 1993 in the first district here, which was then governed by the Conservative Party, but they experienced severe parking problems and parking overflow. They did a before study before they implemented, and I think they measured something like 110 or 120% parking capacity at night because of illegally parked cars. So the first district and the city worked together to get this sort of first parking management off the ground, and they did a before-after study, so parking occupancy decreased. There was parking available. They measured evening and morning. Essentially, what they did was they gave parking passes for a fee to residents, and those who were driving to the district could only park for 2 hours and had to pay, or they parked off-street. It was a success, but the districts around the first now experienced parking problems because many of the drivers started just parking outside of the first district. So they had a second commission bringing, different political parties and different stakeholders of the city together and the districts. And they expanded parking management to those areas in dark blue here. In all of these negotiations, they made some concessions to business owners with some exceptions. Some business owners wanted to have unloading zones in front of their businesses that nobody could park there permanently, etc. And then they had a hiatus in expanding parking management until about 2012, when the Green Party, again joining the Social Democrats, tried to push parking management on more districts. And parking management in Vienna is on the district level. We'll talk about that in a little bit. So the districts have to adopt it, or the district councils have to adopt it. And you see a couple of the districts here in light blue then adopted parking management, but not all of them. What they also do in Vienna is they have these summer sidewalk cafes. They call them Schanigarten, where they use former car parking spaces as a restaurant space. Now to the new development I talked about before with the subway expansion. The Seestadt is a former airport for small planes, quite outside of the city, but within the city limits. And they are redeveloping it into Seestadt, which means Lake City, and they have this sort of fake, at least when I was there and the way it looks here, the color, they have this lake in the center. They have two metro stops, one here and one there, and there's one also close by that we don't see here. And they are redeveloping it in a mixed, dense fashion, and importantly, before the development opens, they have all the subway service already in place. And you see the photo I took towards this. Look, it's not a nice commute, but at least when you move there, you can use the metro already now. It's for 20,000 residents and 20,000 workplaces. Hamburg has something similar in this towards the city center, the Hafen City for 6,000 housing units. In the U.S., we also have examples for that. You may have heard of the Roslyn-Ballston corridor in Arlington, which when the metro came to Washington, D.C. in the 1970s, the chosen routing for metro was in the median of a highway, and Arlington County said, no, we pay the extra cost, we want to put metro underground underneath Wilson Boulevard in the Roslyn-Ballston corridor, which is our main street. And around that, they designed what they called the bullseye concept. Today we would call it transit-oriented development, but in 1972 they didn't have that term yet. And here again is a before and after photo. So it was sort of an inner suburban, relatively low-density suburb that is within that corridor where they changed the zoning is now transformed into a higher density. We're looking towards Washington, D.C. So D.C. is back here. This may be the National Mall. That's quite close to the city center. But again, similar to what they are doing in Vienna, so higher density mixed use around public transport. I want to start concluding with a little bit of a political story about Vienna and how they implemented, or what the background was to implementing these policy changes. So Vienna is the largest city in Austria. It's a city and also a state, and it's the Austrian capital. Interestingly, all mayors in Vienna have been social democrats since 1945. So it's a one-party, or has been a one-party city. The current mayor has been there since 1994. At one point, this presentation had photos of him over time to see how he ages. So we decided against it. So he's still there. He won 5 elections or something like that. Vienna used to have still the social democrats have that consensual decision making behind closed doors culture. So even during the interviews, it was very hard to get at conflicts and how people disagreed. But many decisions are prepared behind closed doors before they go public. This has changed a little bit since the 1990s, but was definitely the case before. They have elected district governments, 23, that make decisions on neighborhood issues like parking, local roads, traffic calming, and bike lanes. They don't make decisions on city roads, which are more arterial roads, but they make decisions on local roads in their district. The city also has now somewhat of a tradition to use public referenda for specific questions, for example, parking management. Or that's when the Green Party tried to move parking management away from the district government to the city government, which was rejected. And the shared street we talked about before, where the two city districts voted to implement the shared street there. Vienna has been slow to change its transport system. So they were very slow in building a subway. And first they tried to improve the trolley system, and then they tried to tunnel it, and that didn't work, and then they moved towards the subway. They were also slow in adopting highways, though. So being slow can be, in this case, beneficial. The city protects large areas from development. About 50% of the city's land are used for parks, woods, vineyards, and green space. So they have a sort of dense development with narrow streets and relatively few wide arterials. But, as in all cities, increasing affluence, car ownership, cost problems. So the car ownership in Vienna increased from 90 per 1,000 population to 360 between 1960 and 1990. So increasing wealth and car ownership with associated externalities. Preservation of Old Town became a priority already in 1974-75 when they opened the car-free zone in downtown. Talking to 32 interviewees in Vienna, they agreed that the two main policies they implemented to achieve this change in car mode share between 1990 and 2015 was expansion of the metro and parking management, as we already talked about, from 0 to 16 districts. Other things that were mentioned was the traffic calming, the car-free zone, cycling, but there was no agreement on that. Especially on cycling, you could hear quite negative comments from some part of the interview partners, but nobody criticized the subway, and also parking management, so all agreed. If you look back, those policies, a lot of these policies were already set in the 1980 transport plan for the city. They were not concrete there yet, but they were big ideas to expand and speed up public transport, restrict on-street parking, improve walking, cycling conditions, etc. So that's sort of the root of these changes. What has changed in Vienna since 1990 is here put together in a graph indexed to 1990. That's the increase in metro network length since 1990, almost doubling. That's the increase in regional public transport service. That's the increase in residents living in parking management areas. So you see the different expansion. Now over 50% of Vienna residents live in such areas. This shows you the share of local roads that are traffic calmed, going from about 25% to 80%. And then we have the transit share, public transport share of trips, going from slightly less than 30 to about 40%, and the car share of trips going down from 40 to less than 30, and that's 27%. So Vienna has cautiously waited to adopt policies that were proven successful elsewhere. So Vienna has not invented the subway, they have not invented traffic calming, they have not invented parking management, they have adopted policies from elsewhere. And we think this may help explain a little bit this waiting and avoiding risk of failure, why one party could be in power for 70 years. Not that everybody votes just because of transport, but this cautious nature, we think, could be related to this. There's been a long-term, multi-staged implementation over decades of these different policies. So for the metro, we saw that. There was stage one, stage two, the same for the parking management. Things evolved in stages. There was a trial and error process with adjustments if necessary. As for the parking management, for example, they gave different sorts of concessions for different districts. They were very good at having before and after studies, especially for the parking management, and able to measure success. They still have this sort of consensual approach, including all stakeholders, even for small things like removing car parking spaces. I talked to the Chamber of Commerce representative, and she said they get invited to too many meetings about parking spaces. They can't go to all of them. They only pick the important ones. They have occasional referenda on controversial issues. Again, the mayor seems to take the approach, if things are not that clear in transport, he throws it out to a referendum and then follows that. Again, it may be a risk-avoiding strategy in some sense. They implemented policy packages that include benefits for everyone. We talked about that a little bit when we look at public transport. So the public has a benefit of a great public transport system at low cost. You have labor that has an interest in the workplaces created, the unionized workplaces created around public transport. You have industries that are building public transport infrastructure and public transport vehicles. So you have packages that have benefits for many. The parking management is voted on by the city district, and they have the main benefit of the parking. Those who drive there from outside of the city who can't park there, then they're not voting. There's local decision-making on changes on neighborhood streets. For some items like bicycling, this can mean that there's discontinuity in the local road network because different districts make different decisions. But in general, parking management and local road issues are left on the neighborhood level. It's a multimodal package that includes disincentives for car use and incentives for other modes of transport. But overall, public transport has been the main item that stands out. And one quite high-ranking representative in Vienna told me that public transport is like brainwashing in Vienna. They tell each other how great public transport is, and that you could wake a Viennese up at night and they would be able to tell you how great the public transport system is. So I don't know, but it was quite interesting having it described as brainwashing each other about it. And I think there are ratings about how is your public transport service good or very good is in the mid-90% range. So there's really broad acceptance of that. So concluding overall, the five cities we looked at adopted the same types of policies, but it was a different mix. So the German cities, especially Munich, have done more on the bicycling side, while Zurich and Vienna have done more for public transport, for example. It's an integrated combination of high-quality public transport, walking and cycling, that then helps to outcompete the car, gaining back some of the modal share they had lost in the 60s, from the 60s to the 1990s. And also as a backbone of that, a consistent land use policy that encourages compact and mixed-use development. And there you have the view again on Vienna, where you see the mixed use and dense development. Now I can try to answer some questions. Thank you.